Join us Tuesday, February 13th for the 35th anniversary of the Open House Moving-In Party. Food, drinks, tours, and memories will be on hand as we celebrate 35 years in this building and 50 years of KVU. That's the 35th anniversary open house, Tuesday, February 13th, 5 to 8 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkbu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the second Quanise Hayes Angelversary on Saturday, February 10th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Portland Police Bureau's East Precinct in Portland. On February 9th, 2017, teenager Quanise Moose Hayes was shot 3 times by police, once in the head execution style, kneeling and trying to follow conflicting police commands. This peaceful protest is in memory of Moose. Again, that's the second Quanise Hayes Angelversary on Saturday, February the 10th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Portland Police Bureau's East Precinct, 737 Southeast 106th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Disability Rights Oregon is the federally designated agency that upholds the civil rights of people with disabilities. My guest is Sarah Radcliffe, an attorney with Disability Rights Oregon, who recently released the report, Don't Look Around, A Window into Inhumane Conditions for Youth at NorCor. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Sarah, let's start by explaining, what is NorCor?
NorCor is a regional jail in the Dalles. It has an adult side that draws from a number of counties, but the structure of NorCor is a partnership between 4 counties, Wasco, Hood River, Gilliam, and Sherman. So there's the adult side, and then there's a much smaller side for juveniles, children. And that side, the juvenile side, draws from 17 Oregon counties, including the Warm Springs Reservation.
So, Sarah, how old are these kids incarcerated at NorCor?
So the kids are between 12 and 17 years old. Occasionally, they will admit a child younger than 12, but they need a special court order in order to do that. Most of the kids are around 14 to 16.
And how many?
On the occasions when we visited, there were about 20 to 22 kids there. What I'm told is that population is usually a little bit lower. We looked at the booking data for the first 10 months of 2017, and 276 kids came through NorCor during that period.
And I understand there are some ICE detainees also.
Yes, there are some children there who are ICE detainees. I think it's generally around 2 or 3 kids who are there on that status.
And the ICE detainees, those kids can come from anywhere in the country, is that correct?
Yes, some of the ICE detainees that we interviewed were from as far away as Massachusetts or South Carolina. Yeah, so they're very far from their families.
So what crimes did these kids commit? Why are they incarcerated at NorCor?
There's a range of reasons that kids end up at NorCor. We found that, according to data provided by NorCor, about a third to a half of the kids there are there for probation violations, and sometimes that's a technical probation violation. Some kids are there for a 30 to 180-day program, which would be an alternative to sending kids to Oregon Youth Authority custody. A few kids were there for Measure 11 charges. So of that 10-month period that we looked at, three of the kids had been booked on Measure 11 charges, so pretty small number. But, you know, in talking to kids and to the juvenile directors, the overwhelming message that we heard is that the driving cause for kids' involvement in the juvenile justice system is failures in our community behavioral health system and a resource-strapped child welfare system. So oftentimes, if there were other viable options for these kids, such as, you know, an appropriate foster home placement or residential treatment or, you know, just robust wraparound mental health services, juvenile directors felt that they could have prevented involvement in the juvenile justice system.
You said earlier that half the kids are at NORCOR for violating their probation. So what does that mean?
So if a kid is charged with an offense, then probation is offered as an alternative to detention. And the probation will require that the youth comply with a number of terms that'll be tailored to that youth. So it could be, having clean drug tests or doing community service or going to school every day, going to mental health appointments, going to drug and alcohol treatment, you know, and staying out of trouble. If the youth doesn't comply with those terms, then courts and juvenile directors have a lot of discretion about whether they use detention as the remedy for that violation. Some of the data that NORCOR reported to us as probation violations may have been kids who are actually enrolled in the program at NORCOR. But the circumstances that would result in a referral to the program are not that different than the circumstances of a probation violation. I mean, the bottom line is that what we're seeing is kids spending way too much time in jail. But yes, about a third to a half of the kids at NORCOR are there for probation violations. And most people call juvenile detention, but in writing our report, we felt like that was a euphemism that made it sound like something other than jail. I've been in a lot of adult jails over the past couple of years, and NORCOR's juvenile detention facility feels like a jail. So we made a choice to call it jail, to call it incarceration, rather than to call it juvenile detention.
Your report says that over the past 2 years, DRO has been monitoring adult county jails. How did you come to investigate the children at NORCOR?
So my job specifically focuses on the nexus between mental illness and institutionalization. So trying to keep people with mental illness in their communities and out of institutions, and then also trying to protect people's basic rights when they do end up in institutions. We know that people with mental illness are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system and in jails in particular. So I was at NORCOR to visit the adult jail. And while I was out there, I thought, well, there's a juvenile detention facility here as well. Why not have a look? So I hadn't intended to have juvenile detention facilities kind of on my itinerary, but once I went into NORCOR's juvenile detention facility, it was pretty apparent that we needed to invest some resources into a more complete investigation.
And your report states that the conditions for youth at NORCOR were harsher and more restrictive than any adult jail you had visited.
So what we saw was kids as young as 12 years old who were locked in their cells for multiple hours each day. Most kids reported that they spent about 3 to 6 hours per day in their cells. And when they were in their cells, they didn't have access to basic coping tools, things like books or pen and paper or, you know, a ball to toss. And contrary to requirements in state law, there was no documentation around how long or how frequently kids were locked down in their cells. We also were pretty shocked by the series of 62 rules that kids are required to follow that really just felt arbitrary and not related to any legitimate purpose. Things like, do not look out any windows. You will not ask what time it is. You will remain on silence until staff gives you permission to speak. You will look forward at all times. And then if kids violated those rules, then they were subjected to the disciplinary process, which was, it basically denied kids meaningful human contact, sometimes for weeks or even months.
And you found that NORCOR holds kids in what amounts to solitary confinement, even children who are suicidal.
Yeah, so what the disciplinary status looks like is kids are denied, and this is according to NORCOR's written policy and what kids reported to us. NORCOR has since said, well, we often don't follow our written policy, so that may be the case. But according to kids' reports and their written policy, the disciplinary process denies kids access to phone calls and visits with their family members. They're not allowed to have a book or any other materials in their cell with them, and they receive their meals, their education, and their exercise on a solitary basis. So while you might have a staff person come to the cell and say, you know, time for your shower, or are you okay? Effectively, this disciplinary process denies kids access to human contact. And it also constitutes sensory deprivation, because a long period of time in your cell without anything, you know, any kind of human interaction or anything to do is actually, you know, it's detrimental for any person. It's especially detrimental for children. There's studies that show that, you know, because children's brains are still developing and just because, you know, of where they're at in terms of their psychological development, that lack of human contact can cause lasting damage for kids.
And socialization is so important to the development of teens and, mm-hmm. and young children.
Yeah, we talked to kids. You know, one of the questions that I asked in my interviews was, what would help? What would help you cope? You know, I remember talking to one boy who was just desperate for a pen or pencil. He loved to draw and he felt like, you know, that was a healthy coping tool for him. And he had been total, he was on disciplinary status for 69 days. And during this time, he was scratching at his arms and punching the walls. And he felt like he could alleviate a lot of that stress and that pent-up emotion simply by drawing, and that was a tool that was denied to him.
What were some of the other coping tools that mm-hmm. kids asked for?
Sure. I talked to one boy who he was really proud that he had basically raised his younger siblings and kept them safe and, you know, gotten food for them and things like that. And he and his siblings had finally gotten into a foster home that he felt like was a really good situation for them. And I don't know what the underlying circumstances were, but for whatever reason, he felt that he wasn't going to be able to go back to that foster home and be with his siblings. And I asked him what would help, and he said a ball, just to have a ball. You know, he was processing a lot, and he felt like just to have a ball in his cell that he could toss up and down would really help. So, I mean, very modest requests that these kids were making.
Getting back to solitary confinement, Sarah, your report says that even kids who are suicidal are being held in these conditions. So why is an Oregon facility using this cruel and inhumane punishment on children?
The way that the correction system deals with suicide risk, and this is certainly true in adult jails, is to deprive the person of anything that they could potentially use to harm themselves. So they'd take all materials out of the cell, they'd make the person strip down and put on a suicide smock, and they'd put them on suicide watch. We've argued in adult facilities that this response is perceived as punitive and actually discourages people from coming forward and voicing their feelings about suicidality. And it's not based on clinical considerations that are, you know, tailored to the individual risk. So, you know, a book, for most people, a book is not going to be a tool that someone is going to use to harm themselves.
Or a ball.
And what research shows, you know, what the clinical perspective shows is that the most effective intervention to ameliorate risk of suicide is human contact. People need somebody to talk to. That's what helps. So that's it's an approach to suicide risk that we're really familiar with on the adult side. But I was really saddened to see that approach used on kids as well. So what kids told us was, you know, if they engaged in self-harming behavior or if they expressed a risk of suicide, that instead of getting somebody to talk to and somebody to, you know, kind of talk them through it, what they got was being put in an observation cell and being kind of shut up alone.
More isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So in 2016, the United States Department of Justice banned the use of solitary confinement of youth in federal prisons. And just last year, Oregon passed legislation to prevent the Oregon Youth Authority from placing a youth alone in a locked room as a sanction for a rule violation. So what needs to happen for a facility like NorCor to stop using this practice?
It's a lot easier to regulate larger systems, you know, such as the federal system or the Oregon Youth Authority. What we've found is that when you get down to the local level, there's much less regulation and there's much more localized control. So,
and your report says that all Oregon juvenile detention facilities are unlicensed and unregulated. So who is responsible for these conditions at these facilities and accountable for the treatment of these kids?
What we're proposing is a system of statewide independent oversight for juvenile detention facilities. There are some various successful models for what this might look like around the country. But what these models share, you know, in order to be successful, is that they're supported by clear statutory authority. They're given unrestricted access to really get in there and assess conditions, and they're adequately funded. And they're autonomous. So that's kind of what the model would look like. So when we went into NorCor, my initial assumption was, you know, a lot of times people don't know what's going on in a locked facility. It's hard to get access. And so our first thought is always maybe sunlight is the cure. But what I was shocked to find is that 2.5 years ago, the Annie E. Casey Foundation has a program called the Juvenile Detentions Alternatives Initiative. I'm going to call it JDAI. So 2.5 years ago, there was a comprehensive JDAI assessment and report about NorCor. It was conducted with fidelity to this national model, and it was the assessment was conducted by a team of juvenile justice experts, and it resulted in a 115-page report about deficiencies and conditions at NorCor's juvenile detention facility. Basically, this report laid out everything that we were concerned about 2 years later. And this report, all I can assume is that it sat in a drawer for 2 years because none of the deficiencies were corrected. So I think what this really points to is that we lack a system of meaningful oversight, because if everybody knows that these problems exist and that kids are being harmed and nobody's empowered or charged or, you know, accountable with fixing it, then that's a sign of a deeper problem.
Oregon just lacks the will to do something about this.
I think that we have kind of a complicated and splintered system of accountability. And what we really need is one agency that's charged with enforcing basic conditions.
The DRO report contrasts Oregon juvenile detention facilities with oversight at an elderly mm-hmm. nursing home. There's oversight for these elderly homes.
Mm-hmm.
Why not for these kids?
I think that it's a distinction that we've made between, you know, people in the healthcare system and people in the correction system. I mean, when you look at the healthcare system, I do make an analogy to a nursing home. With a nursing home, you're going to have the Oregon Health Authority licenses that nursing home. They're going to have inspectors who can go out and investigate a complaint. You're going to have the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which has their own regulatory oversight system. And you're going to have a long-term care ombudsman ombudsman, who, you know, a fully staffed office that's independent, and family members or individuals can go to the ombudsman's office in order to make a complaint or receive some advocacy services. None of that framework of regulatory oversight exists with regard to any corrections facility, but juvenile detention facilities in particular.
And, you know, research shows that jails are the worst place for children.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here we are. Oregon's child incarceration rate is one of the worst in the country.
So national studies show that juvenile detention actually has the opposite of the desired effect. So most young people outgrow any juvenile delinquency behaviors, but incarceration actually increases the chances that that young person will go on to become more deeply involved in the criminal justice system as they get older. So incarceration for kids really should be a last resort, not only because of the harm that it causes the child, but because of, you know, just what we know about public safety. It actually has the opposite of a deterrent effect.
You said earlier that kids with mental health concerns are overrepresented, but also youth from marginalized communities are also disproportionately incarcerated. Can you talk about that?
So if you look at the available statewide data, African-American youth are referred to the juvenile department at 2.5 times the rate of white youth. And Native American youth are placed in detention at almost twice the rate of white youth. I think that there's been a lot of research around the school-to-prison pipeline, and we know that kids from marginalized communities are more likely to be expelled from school. And then, you know, that just creates a cascading effect of challenges that kids face. So we also found, in terms of technical probation violations, youth who are booked at NorCor on a technical probation violation stayed for an average of almost 76 days, which is more than 5 times the average length of stay for a technical probation violation in Multnomah County. This is not something that NorCor has control over. This is something that, in the interim, each county juvenile director should really take a hard look at what's happening in their county and why kids are getting referred to the juvenile department and why lengths of stay are so long.
What community-based services or programs are desperately needed in Oregon to divert these kids from a place like NorCor?
Well, it's complicated, and it depends how far upstream you want to look. So it's really like our social safety net, you know, affordable housing, adequate education. One of the other issues that Disability Rights Oregon is looking at is kids who are denied access to a full school day. So we know that when kids are pushed out of school, they're more likely to get involved in the juvenile justice system. We need desperately in this state access to behavioral health care, so mental health care and treatment for drug and alcohol addiction. When I go into a jail for adults or kids and spend a day talking to individuals who are there, what I see is the failures of our other systems. So, you know, in the context of kids, you talk to kids and you see the failures of our education system, the failures of our healthcare system, and the failures of our child welfare system. That's what precedes a kid's involvement in the juvenile justice system and placement in detention.
Your report, again, Don't Look Around, calls for the implementation of the Mental Health Task Force report of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the formation of a children's cabinet. And what would the cabinet be charged with?
So a children's cabinet would coordinate the child welfare and juvenile justice systems, from our perspective, to prevent situations where the child welfare system isn't able to adequately serve a youth, and that prompts his or her involvement in the juvenile justice system. But to really like dig in and look at what they call the crossover population, so kids who are involved in child welfare and juvenile justice, and try to come up with a holistic response for those kids. I think what's critical is that, if the children's cabinet is going to be successful, it shouldn't just be agency heads meeting several times a year in Salem. It really needs to be staffed and implemented at the local level.
And has that cabinet been formed since 2016?
No.
Well, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
I go back to the will of our elected officials and just the will of the people charged with taking care of these kids. So how does incarceration or detention impact the social development and mental health of these children?
Well, we know a lot about what works for kids based on psychological research from the past 20 years, or research about child development over the last 20 years. Another recommendation from the Oregon Judicial Department's Juvenile Justice Mental Health Task Force from 2016 was that all child-serving systems adhere to a common set of principles. And those principles are trauma-informed care, so recognizing that most kids who enter these systems have been impacted by trauma, such as abuse and neglect or food and housing insecurity. Another is family and youth voice. So that means seeking input, recognizing and celebrating diversity and diverse and individuality, and addressing bias in the system. So creating some transparency, tracking data in order to unearth bias, and using a strengths-based approach. So that's treatment plans that are asset-driven. So rather than the punitive and compliance-oriented approach that NORCOR uses, a strength-based approach is actually much more effective. Dr. Ajit Jetmalani, who's the director of child and adolescent psychiatry at OHSU, is quoted in our report saying, "Studies of human development clearly highlight the critical importance of attachment and sustained positive relationships as the primary resilience factors that allow for emotional regulation, cognitive processing, and problem solving. When youth experience adults as interested in them, willing to listen, and focused on their safety and success, youth are much more likely to participate in pro-social productive activities." So relationships, positive relationships with adults that care about them, that's kind of the key to inspiring an intrinsic desire to engage positively with the world and, you know, and the hope to kind of build a life. The rules that are imposed at NORCOR feel arbitrary. They don't make sense. They feel unfair. The fact that they're on the books, but sometimes enforced, sometimes not enforced, leaves a lot of room for bias. And those factors make the whole system feel illegitimate and suspect to kids. So they're much less likely to buy in. You know, you're going to buy in if you feel that by playing by the rules, you're assured, you know, some measure of success. But if it feels arbitrary and unfair and unpredictable, that confirms the belief that these kids go into the system with, which is, I'm not safe, I don't have control over my life, and, you know, what's the point of engaging?
So other states around the country are reducing youth incarceration. What can be done?
So there are a couple things happening right now. Disability Rights Oregon's executive director and I testified before the House and Senate Joint Judiciary Committee last week. So we know that legislators are interested in this issue. So I would encourage listeners to call your state legislators and tell them that you're concerned about these issues.
Do you have some personal stories about the kids, Sarah, you'd like to share?
Yeah, I can tell you about one girl who, for the purposes of the report, we've called Brandy. Brandy had made a suicide attempt prior to her stay at NORCOR. And, you know, I think the details are powerful. So we reviewed her records, and most of the time staff noted that she was respectful, polite, helpful, or doing excellent work in school. But nonetheless, she was consistently disciplined for things like, quote, being needy, doing the minimum, doing just okay, flirting, hands above waist, not saying excuse me, or sometimes she was demoted for no documented reason at all. And this was a girl who, you know, had struggled with mental health concerns. And total, she was in custody at NorCor for 5 months. Her initial incarceration was triggered by a probation violation, but her home situation was not viable. And so she was kind of stuck at NorCor waiting for a bed and residential treatment. But then when a bed finally became available in residential treatment, she went there. But it was probably about 4 or 5 hours away from her rural community. She'd hardly spent time in a big city before, and she was unhappy there, and she ran away. And she was gone for, I think, less than 24 hours, but that was a violation of her conditional release. And so she was then returned to NorCor. But just, you know, one example of a young girl who just was making a really difficult journey.
And Sarah, how do you access your report?
So our report, which is titled Don't Look Around, A Window into Inhumane Conditions for Youth at NorCor, is available on Disability Rights Oregon's website, which is droregon.org.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today, Karen. And thanks to our listeners for listening.
I've been speaking with Sarah Radcliffe, an attorney with Disability Rights Oregon, about her new report, Don't Look Around, A Window into Inhumane Conditions for Youth at NorCor. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the second Quanise Hayes Angelversary on Saturday, February 10th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Portland Police Bureau's East Precinct in Portland. On February 9th, 2017, teenager Quanise Moose Hayes was shot 3 times by police, once in the head execution style, kneeling and trying to follow conflicting police commands. This peaceful protest is in memory of Moose. Again, that's the second Quanise Hayes Angelversary on Saturday, February the 10th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Portland Police Bureau's East Precinct, 737 Southeast 106th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud